episode 64, Patrick and Cyprian speak with Mark Mattingly Scott, Chief Revenue Officer at Quantum Brilliance. The team discuss room temperature quantum computers, education and preparation for the quantum market, and parallels to the semiconductor revolution. Welcome to Entangled Things, your quantum computing podcast, hosted by Patrick and Cyprian.
Hey, Cyprian, how are you doing today?
Hi, Patrick. I'm doing well. Looking forward for another episode of Entangled Things.
This should be a good one. So we're joined by Mark. Mark, do you mind introducing yourself to our audience?
Yeah, sure. Thank you. My name is Mark Mattingly Scott. I'm the Chief Revenue Officer of a company called Quantum Brilliance, a German-Australian or Australian-German startup. We make quantum computers. We make room temperature quantum computers. Thank you very much for inviting me to the podcast today.
Oh, very, very excited to have you, because room temperature sounds so much easier than millikelvin.
It is.
So there must be some other challenges I assume that you're working through, but it assumes you're looking to disrupt. This is a disruptive play to try to, you know, get us out of this engineering feats of having these really cold and error-prone systems. What are you guys trying to, what hill are you climbing right now, I guess is the question.
Yeah, I think the quantum computing market, if you want to call it that, which is generating so much interest, it's actually a quantum computing education and preparation market.
You're right.
It's pretty big. I mean, if we look at the historical figures, the last couple of years, how much money's been spent in those markets, it's hundreds of millions already.
Yeah.
Moving forward, if we imagine a time when there's a fairly good chance we've got working quantum computers, let's say in 10 years, that quantum computing education and preparation market will probably still be about the same size, but the market for usable quantum computers is going to be far, far greater. And yes. I always refer to this as we're currently in the making toys for children phase, and we need to transition to the making tools for adults phase. And Quantum Brilliance is about maximizing the chance or being the first company to make that transition to tools for adults. Because, so go ahead.
No, I was going to say, so where's the first market you're going after? Is it optimization? Is it simulation? Is it Shor's algorithm, Grover's algorithm? Or are you guys doing blazing a different path that we're not aware of? Or can you tell us?
Yeah, I mean, I can explain how we look at that market, how we're structuring the market, how we plan to achieve that, being the first. Because the market is an education market and a preparation market, means that the focus of almost the entire industry is on developing algorithms, looking for places where quantum computing will achieve overwhelming computational superiority. That's why you've heard, you know, Google talking about quantum supremacy, and IBM talks about quantum advantage. Our approach is we turn that argument around, and we say, if you had a certain number of qubits and you could guarantee that those qubits were infrastructure free, so none of the, as you said, none of the cooling, none of the vacuum systems, high precision lasers, all that stuff disappears. You've got something which looks like a GPU or a CPU. In other words, it doesn't consume very much energy. It's highly integratable. You can put it in edge devices. You can put it in vehicles. You can put it in satellites. You can actually put it in a rack and put it next to all the GPUs in your HPC center. If you have that capability, what's the minimum number of qubits you need to do one task either faster, more accurately, or with less energy than the purely classical alternative? We call that that inflection point of where we reach that quantum utility. So our approach to being the first to realize commercialization is through this concept of quantum utility. And we're optimistic that that inflection point is going to happen with a surprisingly small number of qubits, maybe a couple of hundred.
Wow. That's fascinating, because most of the time we like the question I framed was more about, well, you know, which markets, and you seem to be very focused, which I think is a refreshing outlook, and caught me off guard. So I enjoyed that. we've always told people, oh, you're not going to have a quantum computer in your back pocket, but maybe you will.
Well,
maybe you'll have a dime in it, because if it's room temperature, maybe I can get away with it.
Yes. Well, I the analogy I always draw is with the semiconductor industry. And this is, you know, my colleagues always roll their eyes when I tell this story, but I'm a child of the 60s. So I remember once a small step for man. I remember the semiconductor revolution. I remember as a very young boy, just, you know, 9, 10, 11 years old, with a soldering iron in my hand, building a microprocessor evaluation thing with an Intel 4004, the very first microprocessor. Wow. And then watching that over the last decades, and I'm an electronic engineer by training, so that's my space. And I see so many analogies in quantum computing with diamond, with the room temperature capability of diamond. It's a material. We can front load all the complexity into a manufacturing process. So that gives us the potential to basically become the silicon of quantum computing. And that's an incredible journey to be a part of. We've got to realize it. And of course, it's not trivial. There's lots and lots of challenges. But what it boils down to at the end of the day is a totally different approach to what everybody else is doing.
We've often talked – oh, go ahead, Cyprian.
No, go ahead.
So we've often talked about the fact that what you just said is where we need to go. So it's very refreshing to have someone who has a plan that is actually seems very reasonable and focused, as opposed to we're going to do this thing and then the world will make it into this stuff. So I find that very great. Go ahead, Cyprian. Sorry about that.
Yeah, I was just thinking about what Mark was saying, right? It certainly seems, and I'm convinced it is, this we're talking here about a completely different modality for building the quantum computers. And that's where I would like to hear a little bit more, because most of the time what our audience is hearing is trapped ions and superconducting qubits and things like that, right? Which all require very low temperatures and things like that. So I would wonder, like, can you explain, like, in layman terms, like, what would be the fundamental difference of the modality that you are proposing? Obviously, besides the temperature, because that's the okay. Kind of the elephant in the room.
Yeah. So, The place you get to do quantum operations, the qubits, they have to be in some sense, spin systems or something with some kind of quantum polarity. In order to create a place where you can actually manipulate those fundamental quantum mechanical systems, you have to create something called coherence. And as you said, and as you know, I think everybody knows that about quantum computers, you have to create coherence by basically fooling Mother Nature into thinking that what's giving us that quote coherent state, and then we can, you know, do some quantum operations on those qubits in whichever form they are. The characteristic or the thing about diamond is that coherent state also exists at room temperature, which means that's why we don't need any of the infrastructure. The way we interact with the nitrogen vacancy, which is where that's the thing with the qubit, is through microwaves, some non-coherent photons, especially when we're initializing and reading out the value of the qubits. And then for the gate operations, we use radio frequencies. So there's three types of energy, microwaves, RF, and in non-coherent photons. They're pretty simple to create and synthesize. If you opened up, the mass control of a 5G antenna, you'd find probably more or less what you need in there. There are, of course, once you get close to the diamond, then things get
sensitive.
But in comparison to other qubit technologies, I'm probably going to regret saying this, but laughably trivial. It's a lot simpler than if you're trying to interact with Josephson junctions, for example, where you have to do microwaves at like millikelvin.
Just for our audience to be clear on it, right? When we talk about the NV vacancies or nitrogen vacancies, right? These are small defects in the structure of the diamond that allow you to essentially isolate a quantum system there and interact with it. Now, the immediate question that popped up in my mind, like these nitrogen vacancies, as far as I know, Mark, are not that frequent in terms of natural occurrence. So the question is, what are the challenges of building like multiple qubits or whatever the equivalent of the quantum system it is in this modality? How do you overcome? Are you like on a path of forcing the creation of these nitrogen vacancies? Or I would be really curious to
that's
to
what
learn
I was
more.
Assuming. I was assuming you're making artificial diamonds with the vacancies where you want them, as opposed to doing something with natural diamonds. But maybe that's the secret sauce and we can't ask that question. So please feel free to say no comment.
No, that's not the secret sauce. So a little bit of going down the rabbit hole on diamonds. Yes, we use synthetic diamonds. Natural diamonds are full of defects, which make them very useful and interesting for other jobs. We use synthetic diamonds. In particular, we use ultra high purity synthetic diamonds. The purity means that there are very, very few defects within the crystal lattice of the diamond, and it means that the surface purity, the unevenness of the diamond surface, is also very, very low. What we do is, or what one does, choosing my words carefully here, is you need to put those nitrogen vacancies in the diamond. And ideally, you want them at a very particular depth and at a very particular separation.
It seems like that's the real hard part to me.
It is.
Then if you get that down, then the rest is just you've. So right now, most of the industry has taken a different road. They're taking, engineering feats, but then maintaining it is so difficult, and the noise and the error rates. I assume that once you get past the, like, we can manufacture, we can put them where we want, if we skip ahead, that there's not a lot of error rates there. Is that something that's expected, or do you expect to have a lot of error rates like most other modalities?
Okay, so this is a fairly fundamental question about nature. Mm-hmm. You're always facing some kind of fundamental limit. Physics, physics has certain things which are unavoidable. There's quantum noise, and you can't get around that. So it's a case of when does that start to matter, and how does that impinge on your qubit system? Does it limit the ultimate gate fidelity, or does it limit the coherence time? So those are questions that are still being challenged and pushed. We're not at the limits yet. We're not near the limits yet. Other quantum computing technologies are close to their limits. With diamond, we're not. The technology itself, being able to create those nitrogen vacancies at very precisely defined separations and very precisely defined depths means that, you know, you can put a very large number of qubits on a very small diamond. What that looks like then in practice when we've ironed out the challenges in making that process work, then the limitations about how many qubits do we have, what's the overall fidelity, what's the coherence time, what's the circuit depth, what can you actually do with that? Those are all questions we still have to answer.
And you don't have the problem of how many wires can I get in, and because you're doing everything through those various means that you described that are all wireless, for lack of a better word.
Well, yeah,
I think it's fascinating.
Yeah, nothing's for free, and you know, my electronic engineer heart is if you give me like, here's the thing you need to communicate with, then I start thinking about Shannon's law and how can I maximize the bit rate for a given noise rate. But as you said, the challenges of implementing that, challenges of doing that, because everything's at room temperature, because we're using relatively simple forms of energy, are going to be considerably less than trying to do that at, I don't know, 10 millikelvin, which I can only, you know, imagine is a horribly big challenge. So yeah, it looks encouraging. But we'll know for sure in a couple of years when we start to get lots of qubits.
That's amazing.
Out of curiosity, like, can you reveal the order of magnitude of the number of qubits that you are currently working with? Like, you are in the tens, the hundreds, right? Or it's something you can't talk about right now?
No, I can't talk about it. So we are using a precursor technology at the moment to basically, I'd say, calibrate and prepare. So in the sense of the educate and prepare phase of the quantum revolution, if you want to call it that. So we have basically very, very simple two-qubit systems using a precursor method of making the diamonds. The exact details and timing of how and when we get up to large number of qubits, there are some projects we're working on, especially in Germany with the German research ministry, where we aim to get up to tens of qubits within the next, I don't know, by 2025, 2026.
Wow. I mean, that's pretty fast out of the gate. You guys started in 2019, if I'm correct.
That's right. Yeah.
That's a ramp up.
And I'm wondering, like, one of the big challenges for the other modalities is related to the topology, right, of the qubit setup, meaning that, for instance, it's fairly easy to build single qubit gates. It's much, much more difficult to build two-qubit gates because of the topology. So I'm curious, with the diamond approach, Mark, is this still a challenge, or it's kind of naturally overcome by the fact that you can basically decide in a much more, let's say, control, easier way and you have much more control over the locations of those vacancies? Or are you still fighting that type of problem as well?
So the problems occur mostly because of the types of energy you're using. If you're just using one kind of energy to do everything, to do initialization, to do gate operations, and to do readouts, then crosstalk becomes a problem.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And there are certain qubit technologies which really suffer from this. If you're using a material where impurities cause, or very, very hard to get rid of impurities, cause parasitic effects, then you're facing a kind of, you know, that's a brick wall. the thing about diamonds is the actual qubit itself is based on nuclear spin. Nuclear spin doesn't care about electromagnetic fields, it doesn't. You read out and initialize the qubits through a dipole spin, through a magnetic spin of the vacancy. So essentially, you've got an input output bus of one qubit. That means that parasitic effects are probably going to be less. We expect those to be not the limiting factor. Certainly, what we see is very encouraging. A lot of questions still to be answered in that area.
I mean, we've said before, no one really knows. We started with vacuum tubes and other relays and things like that, and that's not where the computing industry ended up. And so it's a jump ball still. It's still anybody's game for getting here. And I really am interested in the room temperature options.
Yeah.
And you guys seem to be like one of the biggest groups that's working on that. I don't know that we know what the final modality. Maybe there'll be multiple modalities. Cyprian's pointed me out many times that we might have different things for different purposes. Is there a first market? I know I kind of asked a version of this question. Is there a first application that you're excited to get your teeth into? Is there a first group? Is it chemistry, simulation, optimization?
Right. So, it's a very pertinent question, and one we've been thinking about a lot recently because the market is really heating up, and I think everybody would agree that quantum computing will be a hybrid technology.
Mm-hmm.
But we're not going to see quantum computers operating purely on their own. So the $64 million question then is, how closely can I couple my quantum computer or my QPU with my classical CPU, GPU, ASIC, TPU, FPGA, whatever? In order to have efficient quantum algorithms, if they're variational algorithms, if they're state space exploration algorithms, if they're probability determining algorithms, how close do I need that classical quantum to be coupled? And the answer is as close as you can get it.
Yeah.
In that case, if I'm using a technology which requires lots of infrastructure, I'm forced to put it in the cloud, or I'm forced to put it in a data center. And I'm forced to say to my customers, well, actually, you're going to have to give us your data and classical compute as well. There are lots of companies out there who love it because that's the business model they like. I think, though, that a technology which can be implemented in the way, so that it basically looks like a GPU or a CPU, you physically put it next to a GPU or a CPU, that's going to be the biggest market. And if we look at, for example, and the closest thing we have to this is the GPU market. If you look at how the GPU market in compute, so not gaming, but compute, how that's grown, how it initialized, how there was the innovators played around with it for a couple of years, and then suddenly the market exploded. That's the closest analogy we have. If we take the approach that something similar is going to happen to quantum computing, then the market in 10 years is going to be huge.
Yeah.
If we then combine that with the question, this is me doing a long-winded answer to your original question. So if we then if we combine that with a question like, well, who's going to use it first? It's people using those types of algorithms, and we have a fairly good idea of where those algorithms are being used. I mean, it's certain problems in finance. It's a whole sleuth of problems in chemistry and pharmaceuticals.
Yeah.
It's potentially problems in optimization. Connecting those together to say, who's doing that work, which companies, which enterprises, which industries are benefiting from that, work. In other words, it's computationally intensive work that's happening today with a bottleneck in performance, in accuracy, in speed, or they're consuming tons of energy. Look at all the chat GPT stuff. How many, you know, terawatt hours of energy were needed to train those? And I'm not saying that quantum computing is going to be relevant for chat GPT, but if we can find a way to improve that, then we will get there first. If you ask me which industry exactly is going to be first, I've absolutely no idea, because that low-hanging fruit could be anywhere. We need to engage with customers, which we're doing, and work with them to say, if you had 100 qubits at room temperature, or if you had 200 qubits at room temperature, where's the use case where you could say it's either faster, more accurate, or uses less energy, or all three? Because then you've got a business case, and nobody else has got a business case.
Yeah, that's something that's been missing from our dialogue. And Cyprian and I both run companies, so we can relate to that, I think. The market is open. So it sounds to me like there's really no limitations. It's not like you said, well, we're not playing in this space. You guys are going to be able to do anything that a quantum computing should be able to do. And that means that you're nimble. And that's what you look for somebody who's disrupting the market.
Yeah, we talk about quantum computing at compute, which essentially means if you had a QPU the size of a GPU consuming 100 watts, 150 watts, you can actually put them in a rack. You could put 1,000 of them in a bunch of 19-inch racks, just like you would do with GPUs in a supercompute center. Then the question is, if I had 1,000 QPUs with 100 qubits each, what kind of problems could I solve? It's a really interesting question, and a lot of customers are incredibly interested in that.
I think you might have some actors and you know, singers wanting to wear them on there, because it's diamond, so they might want to wear it on a chain.
You wouldn't believe the requests we've had, but yeah. The other one that really gets me excited is if you have something of that size, weight, and power, you can do quantum computing at source, where the data actually gets created. You can put a QPU next to a sensor. You can put it in a vehicle. You can put it in a train. You can put it in an aircraft. You can put it in a satellite. You can put it in an industrial production line. Right where the data happens, you can now say, okay, I've got a quantum algorithm. With 50 qubits, I can reduce my energy requirements for this piece of kit by 50%. That's a business case. You've got a business case.
Yeah.
So at source and at compute, those two deployment scenarios. And then the third one, of course, is on the desktop. So I hope one day soon you'll have a quantum processing unit in your laptop.
I would love that. I have, as it's not probably hidden from anybody, I have a military background. So I instantly thought about going downrange, everything from tracking systems. There was an article a while back where the Chinese had claimed that they could track stealth fighters with quantum technology. I don't know if it ever panned out to be true, but there's so many applications there. And that's probably where a lot of the money is coming from right now, because of the Shor's algorithm fear. And so for better or worse, this education phase of quantum computing, as you say, which I agree with, has kind of been hijacked by governments worried about Shor's.
Yeah.
And so, but I think that this is opening up a lot of things. I could see the military using this. I could see this may be supplementing the IoT revolution, because now it can travel with the sensors.
Absolutely. So IoT and edge, definitely robotics, definitely there. And there are things that we're incredibly interested in exploring.
I hadn't thought robotics. Big space.
Put a QPU into a robot so it can do better motion planning, for example. The military, of course, all the militaries and all the security services are very, very interested because of Shor's algorithm, or because of non-determined, or because of approximate algorithms, which can also more or less factor numbers. It doesn't really matter. Once you've got close to the factors of a large composite number, you've broken encryption. The timescales for those algorithms are very, very long. Decades, but actually for the for all the deployment scenarios we're talking about, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if it's in 10, 20, 30, 40, or 50 years. It's a problem now in those use cases. Yeah. And we see that a lot. Yeah. A lot of inquiries, a lot of interest in that.
Cool.
So one of the things that I like to ask, like almost every single one of our guests is, how do you see the transitioning from concept of classical computing, right, to quantum computing? It's definitely like, if let's assume your predictions, right, the ones that are the most positive ones are going to come through, right? I think at this point, even while we are at that stage where we are like preparing and educating, right, the number of people who are really prepared to jump on the quantum computing bandwagon, right, is not that large. And
yes,
there are lots of people claiming that in addition to building the hardware, one of the big challenges is going to be building the workforce, right? Folks who can actually like operate, program these things. And I would be very interested to hear your take on how do you see that part of the evolution of quantum computing? Where do you think we are right now? Like, how much time do you think it will take us to get enough people ready without kind of like maybe lifting the requirement of holding three simultaneous PhDs to understand things, right? So that we can really start gaining that critical mass that we've maybe seen in the, say, 70s happening with classical computing.
Yeah, I think the when we think about this and this transition from the education and prepare the toys for children phase into the tools for adults, then my legacy, my personal experience tells me there will be an inflection point, and that inflection point, the entire industry will flip. With silicon and semiconductors, it was the MOSFET, the metal oxide. Use of metal oxide for the gate of a field effect transistor. Suddenly you could make lots and lots of transistors on a chip really easily. The yield shot up. We're going to hit a similar inflection point with quantum computing. Of course, I believe that's going to be with quantum brilliance. What then will happen is we will have a business case. We won't have use cases. We won't be talking about supremacy anymore. We won't be talking about advantage anymore. Thousands of qubits will be of academic interest, but the entire world will focus on, there is a business case. How can I make that business case better? And how can I expand that business case to cover things that are close to it? So that inflection point will happen. And the whole industry will basically reframe itself and start focusing on a new perspective on quantum computing. The question about, how do we find the people to then do that exploitation? You mentioned the three PhDs. I thought it was only two, but obviously it's gone up.
I was exaggerating, Mark, on purpose.
Yeah. We actually got people with two PhDs to QB, but it's quite scary. I always used to say back at my previous employer, who shall remain nameless, I always used to say that with quantum computing, you can teach people to read the book, but what we need are people who can write books. And everybody knows that reading a book's dead easy. Writing a book is, for somebody who's done a PhD and written a PhD and went through, hell trying to write it. Because I hate writing. There is a world of difference between being able to read and being able to write. To develop the use cases, to do something useful with quantum computing, you have to be able to write the quantum book for your company, for your application area. That's a big challenge. What I think will happen is when we reach that inflection point, that's when we will see far more focus on training and that whole, you know, how do you prepare people for quantum computing? How do you prepare them to actually look in detail at algorithms? That will become a lot more specific. It will then be about that business case and the things around it, and much less generic. Right now, we're training people to be quantum computing generalists. That will change, and we will then be looking for quantum computing specialists in very particular areas. So I think that will help things, but of course, the demand will, you know, shoot through the ceiling.
We think the solution is in podcasts.
I'm sure you do. I agree with you absolutely, 100%, unequivocally.
No, the reason we're doing this podcast is to educate. We both are very excited. Cyprian and I used to sit at conferences and gather crowds as we discussed quantum, and then people would ask random questions, and we were still like feeling our way through the dark. He was educating me in the beginning, and then I started bringing little tidbits to him, and then we decided to do the podcast. But it really is, it's one of those things where you can't just jump in. Like, I learned HTML in a half an hour. I learned other languages in a day or less. But this hurts your head for the first week. and then you're still like,
hurts my head.
That can't be true for the first year. And we got to get people over that. And so we interviewed, and we keep mentioning this on every episode because it's so exciting. We interviewed a high school teacher in Brooklyn who's teaching quantum physics and quantum computing to his students at a high school level. I think that's what we need to see more of in order for this to be a quantum first world.
Yeah.
And Patrick, the thing that we name, right, the quantum born generation, which are folks who have not went through the bias of classical computing. They've started to learn computing with quantum computing, right? Yeah. That's where I think there will be another quantum leap, no pun intended, in terms of how the things will evolve.
I saw a quote recently, and I'm not going to get it exactly, but it said, science has over the centuries stripped away our sense of magic and mysticism until we got to the quantum level, and then we found out everything is magical and mystical.
I think when we start teaching spin physics at grade school, then the job's done.
We've hit it. Yeah. The Jetsons.
Yeah. I have to write that down, Mark. It's like, that's brilliant. Like,
my head hurts again. So we're up to almost the end of our time. Is there anything else you'd like to highlight or bring up, or conferences you guys are attending, or papers people should check out? We're going to have links on our page for anything that you think our audience should be looking at with your technology and you guys' plans. It's very exciting. But any last thoughts before we wrap up?
Sure. Obviously, there's a bunch of papers that we've published recently on this idea of quantum utility. And understanding how to get to a business case. In particular, we took the idea of the technology readiness level, which was originally developed by NASA, the TRLs. We've taken that idea of a readiness level and developed a model of what we call quantum readiness level. So how close are you to being able to write those books, and a methodology to assess that. And we're looking forward to engaging with customers doing that. There's some literature out there we've published. We're at the International Supercompute Conference next week in Hamburg, in Germany. There's a team of us on the ground there. If anybody wants to come and talk to us, feel free to do so. We'd be very overjoyed to talk to you. Some product announcements coming up. I can't reveal what they are, but in the near future, there's going to be some exciting.
Oh, we're definitely looking forward to it. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. Anything else?
I'm done.
All right, excellent.
No, thank you very much for inviting
me. It's been fascinating. Thank you for joining us, Mark. Cyprian, as always, great to see you. And thanks to everybody who listens, and we'll see you next time.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Thanks.